Some years ago, I remember having a conversation with a friend about the relationship problems that he was having. And after many hours of conversation, it really boiled down to one thing, and it was this. He was able to trust God for his eternal future, but he wasn't able to trust God for his future or not marriage partner. That was the challenge that he faced. The challenge of saying, yes, God is in charge, and I know he's good and he's kind. I know he's got the best for me, but I'm struggling to make that a reality in the present. And I imagine that many of us here this morning have been caught up in a similar situation. We've said to our children, look, God's in charge of where you go to school next year. God's in charge of your exam results. Work hard, but you've got to trust him for that. He knows where he wants you to be at university or college or apprenticeship or whatever. Just trust him for that. Whilst at the same time, we're in turmoil about what's happening at work or maybe fearing for the future of an aged relative. We struggle to apply what we know to be true to our own circumstances. Yes, we know God's in charge, but what does it mean to live under his rule, to live under his sovereign control? It's what we might call practical sovereignty. It's putting that truth, that reality, into practice in our everyday lives. Now, as we've already had reflected in our time together this morning, one of the reasons that we have a confession when we gather is because we know we haven't lived under God's rule. We know that we've preferred to be in charge and to take that charge back for ourselves. And we need to come to him regularly, not just once a week, regularly, and to say sorry for that. And we know that's hard, don't we? Because we want to be in charge. We often think we know much better than God does what's best for us. And we might even go so far as to say what the Bible says is wrong on this matter, or it doesn't apply to me in this situation. Now, this idea of God being in charge may well, if you're sitting here as someone who doesn't yet believe and trust in Jesus, that may be exactly the problem you're struggling with. That may be the stumbling block that is in your way. You want to be in charge. You know what is best for you, and you know the best way to get it. Well, the book of Jonah is a lesson in practical sovereignty. We'll see the sovereign God in all of his glory. And we'll see how Jonah the prophet struggles with this God. We'll see that sovereign character of God laid bare in deed and in word. And we'll get a glimpse into his eternal plans and purposes. So let's begin with our cast list. Whenever you go through sort of an account like Jonah's, you're thinking, well, you know, where do I fit in? Where am I sort of in this piece? Well, let's just sort of see how we might find our place in this account. And the first thing we need to recognize is that we're shocked by the behavior of God's prophet. We're shocked by the behavior of God's prophet. If we could put it more colloquially, Jonah's behavior beggars belief. Jonah's not called a prophet in this book, but he is called a prophet elsewhere in the Bible. In 2 Kings chapter 14, we meet Jonah, the son of Amittai. He is a prophet in the times of a king called Jeroboam the second, who was an evil king. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. So although he was a bad king, the Lord gave him quite a long reign. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He didn't depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. So he follows in his forebears' footsteps, one of the first kings of the northern kingdom. And you'll notice it's not just that he does evil, but he leads the nation in evil as well. He made Israel to sin. But despite being such a bad king, he restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath-Hepher. So Jonah is a prophet of restoration, which is surprising given the nature of that king and the nature of his reign and the direction that his people are taking. And he's also a successful prophet, we might say. His word has come true within a very short time, within the time span of his being a prophet. You can take that away now for a moment, Jonathan. We'll come back to it in a second. So here in verse 2 of chapter 1, he's given a new commission. Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. Now, great could refer to the size of the city. It could refer to the reputation of the city. Evil can mean just wicked, or it can mean it was a calamity and a disaster. So it may be reflecting the words that Jonah is going to speak to the city later. And this word evil, calamity, disaster will crop up a number of times in the book. And it could mean either things both way through. So we just have to look for that. But one thing we do need to know is that three kings before Jeroboam, in a king called Jehu's reign, the northern kingdom had begun paying tribute to Assyria. So it was a vassal state, if you like, to Syria the oppressor. So great and evil, we may need to understand in that light as well. They're great as in they are the oppressor nation, and they're evil because they're taking tribute from Israel. So this is the commission that Jonah is given. What happens next in the light of all that might therefore surprise us. Let's have the next slide up, Jonathan, please. Here we have a map. As you can see, the northern kingdom is in blue. The southern kingdom with Jerusalem, its capital, is below it in sort of pink. The kingdom of Aram in that top right-hand corner, they were the people who had taken some of the northern territory and from whom it had been won back during Jeroboam's reign. So what direction is Assyria and Nineveh in? Well, it's northeast. So it's the green arrow going up through the Sea of Galilee. That's the direction Jonah should have taken. Instead, what does he do? He heads in the opposite direction. He goes down to Jaffa or Joppa. It's the same place, which was a port. And there he boards a ship heading off across the Mediterranean, probably to a place called Tarshish in Spain. It was a mining area that we know was active in this particular period of history. So what does Jonah do? He does the exact opposite of what God asks him to do. He goes in completely the opposite direction. And doing the exact opposite is reinforced in a number of ways in our narrative. You'll see that the first word of verse 2 is arise, as in get up. What do we find Jonah then doing? We then find him going down. And he keeps going down. So although verse 3, he rises to flee, we're told he went down to Joppa, found a ship, paid the fare, went on board to go with them to Tarshish. We discover in the middle of verse 5, that Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and that he is fast asleep. The word there is actually deep sleep, and it contains the sort of the down word. So there's an echo of it there as well. And that's a particularly dangerous place to be, because if the ship was to go down, being in the hold was where you were most likely to drown. And all of this for one reason and one reason alone. Three times in the chapter we're told that Jonah is fleeing from, he's running away from the presence of the Lord. His problem, you see, is with God. And we will discover more of that as the book goes on. But from the very outset, his problem is with God. And we mustn't forget that. And we see that his sort of subsequent behavior is, well, almost reprehensible. He seems quite oblivious to the fact that he's put the sailors in danger. So verse 5, the storm's going on, the mariners are afraid, they take steps. What is Jonah doing? He's asleep. He's laid down and was fast asleep. He seems completely unconcerned. And his inactivity contrasts very sharply with the activity going on around him. You'll notice the word hurled is used of God and the storm, and it's also used of the sailors and the cargo. It's the same words, and it implies great physical energy and activity. All the while, Jonah sleeps. His inactivity is drawn attention to. Look at verse 6. What do you do in trouble? What happens when things are going badly? Well, you pray, don't you? Does Jonah pray? No, he doesn't. He's asleep. He's not bothered. He has to be woken up by the captain of the ship and told to pray. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean by it, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God, because the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." So he has to be told to pray, but there is no record that he did pray. Look over to verse 9. When confronted with the reality of his disobedience, there's no regret expressed. Verse 9, "I am a Hebrew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." What evidence is there that he fears the Lord? Well, none at all. The irony of that statement seems lost on him completely. And in verse 12, he seems resigned to his fate. "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, and the sea will quiet down for you, for I know that it's because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." So Jonah, he says he fears the Lord when he does not. He says he's running from the presence of the Lord, which he can not. Jonah is no hero. So if you were thinking about that book and you think, you know, I want to be Jonah, let me say that's not a great choice to have made. Jonah is not a spiritual giant to be emulated or admired. He's not a great figure of faith standing against adversity, one we should follow. In reality, Jonah looks like his nation. He looks like the people of the northern kingdom of Israel, those whom Jeroboam has led into wickedness and evil. He, like them, is content in his disobedience. He, like them, is deaf to the word of the Lord. He, like them, refuses to cry to the Lord for rescue. He represents the sinful people of the northern kingdom. We might think, well, maybe he's a bit like a church entrusted with the life-giving words, but refuses to pass on the given message, thus putting the eternal destinies of people in danger. We might think he looks like someone or an organization that started out very well, one that the Lord used, but who for whatever reason has now turned their back on him and is deaf to him, refusing him. Jonah's disobedience beggars belief. But then on the other hand, we are surprised by the belief of the pagan sailors. Secondly, we're surprised by the belief of the pagan sailors. And their behaviour is exemplary. They're hired hands, of course, but they are also old hands. Shipping is their life. But look at verse 5. Then the mariners were afraid. This great wind that the Lord has hurled upon them is clearly extraordinary. It's clearly beyond anything they have experienced before. And they know that their ship and their lives are threatened. The ship may break up in verse 4. The captain talks about perishing in verse 6. So the sailors do what they need to do to ride out the storm in verse 5. They hurled the cargo that was on the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But notice they do something before that, don't they? What's the first thing they do? Because of their fear, each cried out to his God. Now, we know that's a relatively normal thing, don't we? I guess you will know people who would never profess to be Christians. Some clearly believe there is no God at all. But a lot of people will say, yes, of course, in extremis, I prayed. That's what people do. They each cry out to their God. Because the severity of the storm is reminding them that something beyond their control is happening. And therefore they need to look for help with that. They seek out Jonah that he might pray too. But as we know, he refuses. And just as we saw Jonah's decline, so we see the sailor's progress. In verse 5, they pray before they act. And that is significant, I think. They pray before they act. Look at verse 10. They fear Jonah's God. Jonah has said, I'm a Hebrew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. Well, we know he doesn't. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, what is it that you have done? They fear Jonah's God. They're already ahead of Jonah. And notice the little bit at the end of verse 10. For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. That's a device that the author uses a few times in the book. There's a reaction, but we don't quite know why. We're only told the reason for it later. He holds things back for us in the narrative just to build the tension. We'll see that on other occasions. Look at verse 14. This time, when they cry out, they use the name of Jonah's God. Therefore, they called out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood. And they also recognize what having such a Lord, such a God, means. For you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you. They sum up what it means to believe in this Creator Lord of everything. You, O Lord, have done as it pleased you. Now in verse 16, we understand their great fear, don't we? They've not only seen the storm and its size, they've also seen the calm. And maybe the calm was more terrifying still. Because if there's a God out there who can do that to the sea, and they'd probably never seen that before either, then he is certainly somebody we need to take seriously. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. They acknowledge him, they fear him, they give thanks to him, and they vow to serve him in the future. And interestingly, comparing their response to that of the people of Nineveh, they go much further in acknowledging this God, naming this God, than the Ninevites ever do. So as you can see, the contrast between the sailors and Jonah could not be greater. Not only in their response to the Lord God himself, but also in their response to Jonah. Have a look at verse 13. Jonah said to them, "Pick me up, throw me into the sea. I know it's my fault. It'll calm down if you do that." Nevertheless, verse 13, the men rowed hard. They dug in to get back to dry land. They try to do their very best for Jonah. They know that to chuck Jonah into the sea at this point is a death sentence. They want to rescue him from that. And that contrasts, doesn't it, with Jonah's behavior towards them. He seemed to have little concern at their future for so much of the time. They do all they can for him and to save him. So you see, here the account turns on its head, doesn't it? We might expect to see the prophet behaving better than the pagans, but it's the other way around. They outdo Jonah every possible moment. They're much more aware of God. They're much more concerned to know him and to serve him than Jonah is. You can take that away, Jonathan, now. Thank you. And they are a foretaste of what is to come. Not just in the book of Jonah, but in the whole Bible story and history story of salvation. We'll read the next installment in chapter 3 in a couple of weeks' time, of course. But we see the same thing happening during Jesus' ministry. We see the same thing happening in the Acts of the Apostles, don't we? Those who reject Jesus are those, in a sense, who are closest to the promises, those to whom the law was given. It is the Jewish leadership who can't cope with Jesus. It is the synagogues who throw Paul and the others out in the Acts of the Apostles. It is the Gentiles who receive the good news of Jesus' life, death and resurrection better. And of course, all of us who are sat here this morning who are not from a Jewish heritage are part of that same story. We are evidence of this saving work of God. So let these sailors be an ongoing encouragement to us. Notice particularly the priority they give to prayer. Sailing was their livelihood, the sea was their workplace, the ship was their office. But rather than trust their own expertise, their own experience, they pray first and then they worked. And I guess being competent Tunbridgewellian sort of people, we could do well to follow their example. Pray first. Let's follow their example too, in terms of their thanksgiving and their commitment. This is a God they barely know. And yet, they recognize that he is the one to whom they owe their rescue. He is the one to whom they owe their lives. Therefore, he is the one for whom they will now live. So Jonah's disobedience is contrasted with the behavior of the sailors. Thirdly then, let's look at the sovereign Lord himself. Our hope is in the sovereign Lord, for he is the one who is at the center of the book. Our hope is in the sovereign Lord. The sailors have reminded us of what is true of him. He does what he pleases. That is, he ensures that his plans and purposes come to pass. Now, knowing someone's in control, knowing someone has power is one thing. The critical thing is how are they going to use that power? And all too often in our experience, in our world, we see people using that power and that control for ill, don't we? We see them using it to feather their own nests and to furthering their own ends. How does this God use his power and control? Well, we know from the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis chapter 3 that his plan is to overthrow evil. We know from Genesis chapter 12 that one is coming, through whom he will bless all the nations of the world, that all the nations of the world may know him through this person, this Jesus. That is God's plan and purpose, and that is what he uses his power and control to work towards. Let's have the next slide up, please, Jonathan. Oh, no, sorry. There we go. And here in Jonah, we see that power and control. We see it over his creation. Have a look at verse 4 with the wind. Have a look at verse 13. We see it with the fact he wouldn't allow the sailors to reach land safely. We see it in the way in which he stops the sea from raging in verse 15. And of course, we haven't got to the fish yet. We see his power and control over creation. We see his power and control over his prophet. He tells Jonah to go. He may do that. We see it in verse 7, when the lot falls on Jonah. We see it in verse 15, when he's hurled over the side. And that punishment, if you like, that judgment is a great sign of hope. Because it tells that God hasn't given up on Jonah. He could just have let Jonah go to Spain and found another prophet, couldn't he? But he doesn't do that. Jonah is going to be recycled and reused. He is still part of God's plan and purpose. Therefore, he works with him and brings him back to himself in ways that we'll see more of next time. And if Jonah stands for the people of the Northern Kingdom in their rebellion and wickedness and deafness, then there is hope for them too, isn't there? God hasn't given up on his prophet, even in his disobedience. But of course, in many ways, the most glorious way in which we see God's sovereign power and control is in what he does with the pagan sailors. So verse 16, the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. They are rescued by this God as they call upon him. Now, what was God's plan in the first place at the beginning of the chapter? His plan was that Jonah would go to a pagan nation, a pagan people, and tell them the truth about God in the hope that they would turn. What happens? He goes to a ship manned by pagan sailors. He tells them about his God. And what happens? They hear and they turn and they trust and they devote themselves to this God. That is God's plan and purpose. To bring the good news of Jesus to an unbelieving world. From the lips of Jesus in the Gospels, we're told that the time from his ascension to his return, that one period of history is for one thing and one thing alone. It's so that the whole world can hear about Jesus and have the opportunity to turn to him. That's what these days are for. That's what God's plans and purposes are. And that is what he's using his sovereign power and control for. As we've said, we see it here as evidence of that. But having been a place that fostered some great mission movements in the past, the UK and other parts of our world are in desperate need of re-evangelization, of hearing again that good news, because we've forgotten it too easily and too readily. Throughout Jonah, it's the Lord who takes the initiative, and he uses his power, his control, for the good of his world in order to bring them back to himself, that they may know, love, and serve him. So how do we feel about knowing and serving such a sovereign God? Maybe he's not your Lord yet. Well, remember the sailors. They started that journey knowing nothing of him at all. But they came to know him as their Lord for themselves. Let's remember too that because he is the sovereign Lord, his plans and purposes will out. They cannot be thwarted. His will be done. And his saving word will accomplish that for which he sends it forth. There will be a gathering of people from all around the world, from all nations and tribes and tongues. So let us submit to him and to his will and his purposes. Let's serve him and his will and his purposes. And let's rejoice that we may indeed be part of his plans and his purposes today. Let's rejoice that he is a God who uses his power and his control for good. Let's rejoice that he is indeed the Lord who does as he pleases.